In the light of the horrible events surrounding the fall of Jerusalem, do you think Jeremiah would have preferred to die or suffer through with his fellow countrymen? Welcome to The Good Word. I'm Alden Thompson, your host and study guide author. We continue our series on Jeremiah. Our topic today is the destruction of Jerusalem. My conversation partners are Dave Thomas and Matilda Fry, both of them from the School of Theology at Walla Walla University. Let's come to that question, and I'm playing off something that we looked at earlier in the quarter, namely Jeremiah's powerful lament in one of his confessions that he wished that he had never been born. Oh, that he could have been in his mother's womb and stayed there forever. So I would be interested in your reaction. We've looked a lot at the book of Jeremiah. We've kind of absorbed it. What do you think? Would he prefer to have his life ended? Or did he have a choice in the matter?
Well, do we know what really happened to him? I mean, one of the traditions is that he ran away down to Egypt with a group of exiles, right?
Yep. Well, he didn't run away. He was taken there against his will.
Oh, okay.
Probably died down there.
Yeah. So did he see the destruction of Jerusalem, or did they escape during it or after it? What happened?
I believe that he was, putting the pieces together, he was in the vicinity when Jerusalem.
Yeah.
In fact, during the siege, he left to go out to Anathoth, and they put him in the stocks because they thought he was being a traitor.
Yeah.
But he was so convinced of the return that he actually went out and bought a piece of property and had it sealed. But others saw that as being a traitorous act. Matilda?
Haynes and Temple Longman say that Nebuchadnezzar actually gave him a choice. Could that have been? in the sense that he was to be taken to Babylon, but he chose to stay.
Yeah, he gave him, I think, Nebuzaradan, I think, was, said, you have a choice. You're free. You can go wherever you want.
Mm-hmm. And probably because of the way he predicted what was happening,
because
they were more careful with luminaries.
And they treated him well because he was actually the one who preached in favor of the Babylonian king.
Right, yeah.
So I don't know. Who wants to volunteer for suffering?
Well, that's a fascinating question and a painful question, because I've talked to hosts of people who admitted quietly after dark that their most important things that they've learned in life came in the difficult times.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, you don't choose it,
yeah.
But when you've gone through it, you say, well, I sense the Lord's presence there in a very powerful way, and I'm grateful for that.
I remember a testimony of a man who spent 12 years in prison in Cuba, being prodded with electric cattle prods, tortured and stuff like that, 12 years for preaching the gospel. I don't remember how he got out, but he gave the story, and he said, I would never want to do that again, but I wouldn't trade it because of what it did in my life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he stayed with those people who were left behind. Those people who were left behind were not the ones who were like on the priestly line or the kings and princes. They were all taken, and in Babylon they were supported by the prophets who were there, like Daniel, like Ezekiel, mm-hmm. and so on. So he stayed with the ones who were the most disadvantaged, actually.
Yeah, so these would have been the poor peasants who the Babylonians weren't much interested in.
Yes.
They wanted the wise people.
They took everyone who was anybody.
Yeah. Yes.
This is the way I think it's described.
Right.
See, yeah.
Well, that's quite a remarkable statement, though, about Jeremiah's willingness to do that.
We'll come to, in a couple of lessons, we're going to talk about going back to Egypt, because that is actually a shocking experience.
Mm-hmm.
For me, when I read it through this time, I was just dumbfounded by the implications of what happened there. But there is a question, and Dave, you mentioned you wanted to talk about this. With the temple gone, what were the implications for regular worship for those in Babylon and for those left in Palestine? You're so used to the rhythm of going to the temple.
Yeah, and I mean, when you look at the central role the temple played, it was far more to Israel than just a building in which to worship. I mean, this was the where God could be found, at least in the beginning. It's where all the religious rituals were central to religion, were to play out. If a Christian church is robbed of a building, it's very different than, this would almost be like saying that Islam loses Mecca, doesn't have Mecca anymore.
Yeah.
And I was on a tour this summer, and the tour guide, he was a Jewish man, and he reflected on the great challenge that the Jewish community has faced of trying to maintain a community without a central place to look.
That is when religion becomes personal, maybe.
Yeah, but it has to be communal too, though.
Yes, so have Jews over thousands of years learned something that we not know of at this point? When it is the community, the family, the personal relationship, that is what is of value, actually.
Well, one of the questions that I wanted to address here, and I don't know whether we have time, is the importance of place.
Mm.
You know, we haven't moved a lot, although it's been interesting. You know, I've been teaching here since 1970, and we've always had a home to come back to. But the first house we lived in didn't have any tie for our family at all, none. Now, it may have been because there was water in the basement and things like that, but when we moved, I was amazed that none of us in the family had any sense of attachment. I have more attachment to the family cars that we've had, you know, my old 69 Chevy Malibu that I bought new, you know. Now, there's something to tie yourself to. I think you've got a Model A, don't you, Dave?
Yeah, I have two.
You've got two of them, see. So I don't know how important place is. And, of course, one of the questions in our modern world that we face is sacred texts, sacred places. I mean, everything's gone electronic. You know? You can do everything, and somehow cuddling up with a computer isn't quite the same as taking a book that you can mark and streaming to a house of worship. And, of course, what Americans do now, they stream to a sports place, you know, where you come together and get this communal noise and everything else. So,
you know, Olin, you, what you're saying there causes me to think kind of on a macro level about the destruction of Jerusalem. I mean, not only are there the horrors of war, which were terrible in those days, probably more so than even now because fighting was so intimate, you know, but what does it mean that the city of God is now destroyed and that the whole history of the covenant that begins is announced in Deuteronomy and plays out through the whole history? What happens in the mind of people who know that history, if there are some, and they see this, which I think Jeremiah certainly must have seen? How do you negotiate that? What happens to your faith in God when the city that he is known by his name is now destroyed by an enemy?
Yep.
Ooh.
Except, Dave, it is God himself who has delivered the city. That's the astonishing thing.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know what they would make of that, except, you know, as you look what happens after 586, and this is interesting with the book of Chronicles and the books of Kings, it's generally considered by most scholars that the book of Samuel Kings was written very close after the destruction of Jerusalem for the purpose of making the point that even our best kings were basket cases. Because if you read Chronicles, all the nasty stuff about David and Solomon are gone. See, Elijah, Elisha are not even mentioned because they were in the northern kingdom. See, and so by the time you get to Chronicles 150 years later, now they're saying, hey, our argument's weak, we're going to have to shout a little bit louder. And these wonderful Passovers. So, but the question that happened 586, when you read the story of Samuel Kings, we think of Samuel as a man after God's own heart, but he was a basket case. After Bathsheba, he had no moral authority with his family. So if you want to know the nasty stuff about the kings, read Samuel Kings. It's all there.
But I'm even thinking on a bigger level of that if you are part of a community that has built a religious ethos around a place, and that place is destroyed, where do you go? What do you do? How do you hold on to religious functions?
Yep.
You know, it's a big thing.
And I think that's one reason why the Jewish community struggles with secularization so much.
You know? Yeah.
They've replaced the sacrificial system, the ritual, with ethics, see. And while ethics are important, if you don't have any ritual to go with it, it can be very empty.
But there is also the other side, I think, that the people now, as they are gone, and the temple is gone, the city is gone, that the people must relearn that their God, whom they built a temple, Solomon, and when Solomon prayed, he says, this house cannot contain you. God is bigger than a house. God is bigger than the city. God, this God that is their God is the God of all, of the whole world. So they have to go back to those places that in our Bible are at the beginning, the very beginning, the universal, the God who is the God of the whole cosmos, the God of not a place, sacred place, but the God of a sacred time.
Do you remember, Matilda, whether that wonderful prayer of Solomon is in both Kings and Chronicles? Do you remember?
Yes.
Are they the same?
I would need to go back and see.
Because it's very interesting to see what's left out and what's added in.
Yes, yeah.
But Matilda, what you're describing there is exactly the same thing that happened when the Roman Empire collapsed and the Christian church came through with a message of eternity, not just temporality. And so over time, the church then became the glue for society because the Roman Empire had all collapsed.
Even Daniel prays towards Jerusalem, the city, and hopes for it. But at the same time, there is the God who is bigger than that.
And it would be a sobering moment to realize that God himself has given the city away to an enemy because of your communal waywardness.
It took quite some time for Israel to become the it's typically said in scholarly circles that Israel learned their lesson, finally, that they went into captivity because of disobedience, and they would now say, we're never going to do that again, and they became thoroughgoing legalists. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the history, it took them a long time to become good legalists.
And then I think of the remnant that returned and how they must have been full of joy and sorrow.
Yeah.
Amazing that we are back now, but wow, look at this
place.
Well,
you have that story in Ezra where they rebuilt, laid the foundation, and it says there that the old people who had seen the first temple wept, but those who'd never seen a temple rejoiced. And from afar, there was just all kinds of racket. Nobody knew what it was, the sounds of the weeping, the sounds of the joy. So it's really a fascinating story. Unfortunately, we can't go into that post-exilic experience. That's another whole community. Next week, we're going to be talking about the covenant. And again, that's worth a whole quarter all by itself. But that will be an important one for to explore because it is important in Jeremiah. My thanks to both of you for your participation, and my thanks to David Olson, our program engineer, to all of you for listening in. The Good Word, I'm Alden Thompson.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.